proclamation. We're making a statement of faith, a statement of belief. And we believe Jesus is God's Son, that we believe that He is who He claimed to be, that we believe that He is going to return again. We are making a statement, a proclamation about the significance of His death and how it applies to us as His people. We're making the statement, certainly, to ourselves. We're making the statement to the Lord about this is what we proclaim as our belief. We're also making a statement to those who are not Christians who may be present, that this is what we believe. This is where we've placed our emphasis in this life. It's a powerful proclamation that tells the amazing story of Jesus' redemption of mankind in a very simple act. Now, how impactful can that really be? I mean, how much influence can this really have? That people would hear something, if they happened to be in our worship service, that could really have that much of an influence on their life. I want to give you just an illustration of how powerful what you hear can be. If you look in the book of Joshua, the second chapter, it tells the story of the spies that Joshua sent out. They spied out the land. They came back with their report. And then now the people are preparing to enter in to the land. And it tells the story of Rahab and how she gave aid to the Jewish spies who came into the promised land to gain information. But verse 8, I want you to notice this. Chapter 2, Joshua chapter 2, verse 8. It says, "Now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, 'I know that the Lord has given you the land and that the terror of you has fallen on us and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And when we heard it, our hearts melted and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, He is God in heaven above and on earth below.'" Rahab, a pagan prostitute, came to the conviction that the God of Israel is the God of heaven and earth. And she became convinced to the point that she put her own welfare and the welfare of her family into the hands of these men who were the servants. On what basis did she come to that conclusion and that trust in God? She said, "We heard. What we heard about you, about your God, is what convinced us. And now we know that your God is the God of heaven above and the earth beneath." I'm telling you that if we are engaged truly in our worship together, in the proclaiming of the excellencies of Him who called us, if that is before our minds in all that we do, some will hear and can be moved that they, like Rahab, would say, the God that they're talking about, the God that they're worshiping, is the God of heaven and earth and should be my God. And so that's what I ask you today. If you're not a Christian, maybe you are in our midst for the first time. Maybe you are in our midst many times. What is your assessment of the God that you hear about when you gathered here with these people? When you hear His excellency spoken of in prayer and in song, when you see Him worshiped, when you see Him exalted in the minds and the hearts of these people, what is your assessment? Is He the God of heaven and of earth? If you've heard of Him and you've never given your life to Him, then today you need to do just exactly that. Like Rahab did, you need to make that decision. This is the God in whom I must trust. And if you have that trust and confidence in Him, that faith that the Bible speaks of, believing that Jesus is His Son, as you turn away from your sins, if you'd confess Him today, Jesus, confess Him to be the Son of God, if you'd be baptized, washing the guilt of your sins away, you'll become one of His children. One of those living stones that Peter talks about in 1 Peter chapter 2, that is joined together with other living stones in a spiritual house, His temple today, that is built upon the cornerstone of Jesus. That's where you need to be. And we hope and pray that today will be the day that you will make that so. And I encourage you to do it while we stand and sing. Speaking from week to week is talking about topics that people might find of some relevance to their lives, and being inclined then to make some sort of direct application to their lives. And sometimes you feel pretty confident that the topic you're going to talk about will be received positively in that way. And then sometimes you have some questions about whether or not it's going to be very widely received. And tonight's one of those nights where I wonder if anybody is going to really feel like, well, this has any direct relevance to me. I want to talk to you this evening about remembering. And I'm concerned that there would be anybody in the audience here who might have problems remembering things and would need some sort of aid in being reminded of things that are significant, like a spouse's birthday or an anniversary or something of that nature. Certainly all of us have times when we are challenged in remembering the things that really ought to be important, that ought to be at the forefront of our minds. And that's not unlike the people of the Bible. And so I want to talk to you this evening for a few moments about some of the memorials that we encounter in the Scriptures. And look at this from the standpoint of just why. Why are there so many memorials that are spoken of in the Scriptures? And we're just going to take kind of a brief survey of the times when we see in the Scriptures something being done to memorialize some event so that it might be remembered and its significance might stay in the minds of those that were trying to remember the importance of certain events. And the first thing I want you to do with me this evening is to look in the 28th chapter of Genesis chapter 28, that tells the story, that this is part of that story about Jacob, who had difficulties with his brother Esau, and if you remember the story, he had to leave his family. And actually in chapter 28, we see Jacob in the process of leaving. His father has already given him counsel that he ought to depart. He ought to go into to the land of his kinsman Laban, and there he should take a wife. And so in the 28th chapter, we see this transpiring, and Jacob has left. He's on his way. And in the 18th verse, we see where Jacob has stopped for the evening. He has taken a stone and used it for the pillow for his sleep. Verse 18 of chapter 28 says, "So Jacob rose early in the morning and took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up as a pillar, and poured oil on its top, and he called the name of that place Bethel. However, previously the name of the city had been Luz. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, 'If God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take, and will give me food to eat and garments to wear, and I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God. And this stone which I have set up as a pillar will be God's house, and of all that thou didst give me, I will surely give a tenth to thee.'" You remember that as Jacob slept that evening, he had a dream, and he saw a ladder that reached from heaven up into down into the earth, and he saw angels ascending and descending. And when he woke from his sleep that evening, he came to this conclusion that this was the place where God's presence was. That's why he named it Bethel, which means house, Beth, and then El is a form of the name that the Hebrews had for God. It was the house of God. And you see him making this covenant, and he raises up this memorial. This stone was a reminder of that commitment that he makes. A little later on, over in the 35th chapter, we see Jacob, after several years, is on his way back now to his father's house. And in chapter 35, he stops again at Bethel. And in chapter 35, if you'd look in verses 6 and 7 with me, we're told that Jacob came to Luz, that is Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, and all the people who were with him. And he built an altar there and called the place El Bethel. So you get the doubling of the name of God. Because there God had revealed himself to him when he had fled from his brother. He was remembering this event as he was on his journey back again. And there are just numerous occasions where we see people doing this. It happens again in the life of Jacob. If you'd look back into chapter 31 of Genesis, this is between, obviously, the two times that he was at Bethel and remembering his commitment to God, his pledge to God. On this occasion, chapter 31, he's actually leaving from the house of Laban now. And he has to do it in kind of a covert way. He's sneaking away, basically. And we read how in chapter 31 that Laban, when he discovers that Jacob has made his escape along with the daughters of Laban and all the children that had been born to them, the grandchildren of Laban, and then all of the herds that Jacob had amassed through his service to Jacob, that he had left with all of that. And so Laban begins to pursue him, and he catches him. And of course the concern is that there's going to be a slaughter to take place. Well, in chapter 31, an interesting kind of exchange takes place between these two men. I want you to look with me in verses 43 through 53, where Laban answered and said to Jacob, "The daughters are my daughters, and the children are my children, and the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters or to their children whom they have borne?" Basically, he's saying, well, everything you've got here is mine. You really ought not to be doing this. It all belongs to me. But what can I do about it? He's not going to do anything to harm his daughters. He's not going to do anything to harm his grandchildren. And so then this agreement between them ensues. He says in verse 44, "So now come, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me." Then Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. And Jacob said to his kinsmen, "Gather stones." So they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there by the heap. Now Laban called it Yegar Sahudatha, but Jacob called it Galeed. And Laban said, "This heap is a witness between you and me this day." Therefore it was called Galeed and Mizpah. For he said, "May the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent one from the other. If you mistreat my daughters, or if you take wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me." Sounds like a father, doesn't it? "And Laban said to Jacob, behold this heap, and behold the pillar which I have set between you and me. This heap is a witness, and the pillar is a witness, that I will not pass by this heap to you for harm, and you will not pass by this heap and this pillar to me for harm." Sounds like these guys have some trust issues, doesn't it? "The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us." So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. So here we see this commitment, this covenant being made between these two men. It is a reminder, they say, this stone, this heap of stones that they've erected. It is a reminder of this agreement between us. And you're going to treat my daughters right. And I'm not going to do any harm to you. If I were to pass by this heap of stones, it would, with the intent of harming you, it'll be a reminder that we've made this agreement. And you're not going to come in order to harm me. And this heap of stones is a reminder to us of the agreement that we have made. In all of these instances, we see these memorials being spoken of as witnesses. They witness, they testify of that which has been established, of that which is important and significant. Probably when you think, especially in the Old Testament, when you think about memorials or reminders of things that are important, you probably think about the Passover and what transpired on that occasion as God was delivering His children of Israel out of Egyptian bondage. In Exodus, the 12th chapter, we read of how they were instructed to make preparation for when God was going to pass over the land of Egypt, and He was going to strike dead the firstborn in every household, from Pharaoh's household down to the lowliest of servants. The firstborn were going to be struck dead. But in Israel, there would be a deliverance from this plague. If they would do as God was instructing them on this day, they would take the blood of a lamb and smear it over the doorpost, and God would see the blood as He passed over Egypt, as He passed through Egypt, and He would pass over those houses where the children of Israel had responded in obedience to His directions. But then I want you to notice in verse 14 where He says this, "Now this day will be a memorial to you, and you shall celebrate it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. You are to celebrate it as a permanent ordinance." It was a memorial day. It was a day of remembrance throughout their generations. They were on this designated day to recall this great event when God, in His mercy, preserved them and delivered them. In fact, if we were going to make a comparison, I suppose, to our own national holidays, we have a Memorial Day in which we remember the significance of the sacrifice that people have made for our freedoms. We also have an Independence Day when we celebrate the independence of our nation. This is probably a combination of the two. The The Jews were gaining their independence in this event. But it was also a time or a day of significance that they were to remember and that they were to memorialize. Observant Jews to this day continue to practice this. And there is in the traditional observance of the Passover a time, as the scriptures make a reference here, when succeeding generations would ask, what are these things for? The elements of the Passover meal as they were laid out. As children of succeeding generations would ask, what are these things for? God says to them that you will explain to them what this feast, this memorial feast means, and how I delivered you and how your independence was gained by my power. And even to this day, in the traditional observance of the Passover, and as a family observes a Passover, there will be a child present who is given the designation, the honor of asking their parents, what are these things for? And so then the parent would respond by explaining the significance of these events. But it was all based upon this idea of a remembrance and of a memorial. Tied in rather closely to this independence and the gaining of freedom for Israel was another act in which there was a memorial raised. Over in the book of Joshua, chapter 4, we have the story of how at long last these children of Israel who were led to freedom, led out of Egypt, are now brought to the promised land. And under Joshua's leadership, they are to enter into that land. And as they enter in, they are going to cross over the Jordan River. In Joshua chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, we read this. Now, it came about when all the nation had finished crossing the Jordan that the Lord spoke to Joshua, saying, take for yourselves 12 men from the people, one man from each tribe, and command them, saying, take up for yourselves 12 stones from here out of the middle of the Jordan, from the place where the priest's feet are standing firm, and carry them over with you, and lay them down in the lodging place where you will lodge tonight. So get this picture. Here they are. They're ready to cross the Jordan River. And as the preceding chapter describes, God divides the Jordan waters. Very much like the Red Sea when they fled out of Egypt. Now, as they are ready to enter into the promised land, waters are once again going to be divided. And they cross over on dry land. And God gives this instruction after everybody has crossed over and they're into the promised land. God gives this instruction. You take from the riverbed, you take rocks, each tribe selects a man who takes a stone, and then you take them across and you pile them up on the western side of the Jordan River. And these will then form a memorial. Look at verses 6 and 7. Let this be a sign among you, so that when your children ask later, saying, what do these stones mean to you? Then you shall say to them, because the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord, when it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. So these stones shall become a memorial to the sons of Israel forever. As they left Egypt, they crossed on dry land. As they entered Jordan, they crossed on dry land. And they were to remember that event. And that's what this memorial, this heap of stones, provided for them. In the 22nd chapter of Joshua, there's another story about a memorial that is tied to this event of Israel entering into the promised land. When they came to the promised land, they saw that there was land on the eastern side of the Jordan River that was really suited to the keeping of herds and flocks. And the people of the tribes of Reuben and Gad and half of the tribe of Manasseh said, you know, these lands over here are really suited well for us and for our flocks and our herds. So would it be possible for us to take possession of our tribal territory over here on the eastern side? Now we will cross over the Jordan with you, and we will fight with you. In fact, we will commit to being right out on the front lines of the battle until we take possession of the promised land. And once possession of the promised land is taken, then we want to go back across the Jordan on the east side, and we want to live there. And so they made this request in Joshua chapter 22, and the first six verses outline this. And this was agreed to. And so all of this was done, and they kept their word, and they fought, and they took possession of the land, the promised land. And then they crossed back over the Jordan, back to their territory. When you look in the latter part of this chapter, verses of Joshua chapter 22, we find where when they crossed back over the river, they determined what we're going to do is we're going to build an altar here. And it's going to be a copy of the altar that was constructed for use at the tabernacle. And so they did this. They built an altar there on the eastern side of the Jordan River. Well, word of this got back to the other tribes, and they became quite upset about this. Look at verses 16 and 17. It says, thus says the whole congregation of the Lord. They're speaking now to the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. What is this unfaithful